Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
But for example, we have the sightings of the giant birds, the thunderbirds, which people always describe as having feathers. I get a second type of people describing something more quote unquote prehistoric.
I noticed that the wings were really long and they had one bend in the middle. I distinctly saw that.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined today
by me, Count Mark Matzke from, I think I have monsters on the brain because 2 weeks from today, as we are recording this, we will be on our way to Monster Bash.
Yes.
In Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I still have yet to find a dog sitter.
Oh.
So if any of our loyal listeners want to head over to my house for a couple days while I'm gone, watch my dogs, don't contact me. I'm excited for Monster Bash. Anyone, any of our listeners in Pennsylvania interested in hanging out with us in a cool vintage monster environment, head down to Cranberry, PA for Monster Bash. And this year I'm staying at the hotel.
Yes, we are too.
Yeah.
That's the move. That's what you need.
I'm going to have Tommy too. Tommy and Adrian are going to be there. So,
it's a family affair.
This is the official podcast of Small Town Monsters, a independent production company based out of Ohio that I help run. We are sitting in a very messy Small Town Monsters headquarters. Messy because I actually cleaned it up this morning when I came in, just so when you got here, you weren't stumbling over stuff. We still had like all the video equipment and everything laying around from the Momo shoot. So we're going to talk about Terror in the Skies this week because this is, as you're listening to this, Terror in the Skies, the 8th Small Town Monsters film, is available on streaming platforms and DVD. And before I start choking and coughing into the mic, I'm going to take a swig of water.
Take a swig. And I think Kickstarter backers have begun receiving their
rewards
and so forth.
Yeah, I would think
pictures of that online. Yeah. People happily receiving their slipcovers and
stickers. I
got to
get you a slipcover copy because they're gorgeous. Like it looks really great. I had someone tell me yesterday that they think it is worth backing a Small Town Monsters Kickstarter just to get access to the movie so early. Because like the digital copies go out 2 weeks before the official release. So he'd been watching it. He'd already seen it. And like it had completely slipped his mind that the movie isn't even close to release yet.
Yeah.
Like for the last 2 weeks or whatever. Because it feels like it's out already because it hit backers. We missed 2 weeks. We do apologize. We missed 1 week due to Momo filming and just scheduling. Basically, both weeks, we just couldn't get the schedule together. But at least one of those weeks was due to Momo filming. And really, the second week was due to Momo filming. It was a really intense, like, 3 weeks where we were filming four or five days of each week. And one of those weeks, we were actually in Missouri filming. So I feel like I'm still recuperating recuperating from that shoot. Cause that was, it was a very intense shoot, which we will do some sort of show about, the Momo filming. And maybe what we'll try to do in the future is sort of launch these, these episodes live, like the sort of like film centric episodes. Maybe we'll launch them on Facebook Live or something, mm-hmm. and try to get, you know, people to chime in with questions and stuff like that, so we can answer those. I probably could have done that right now, actually, but we're already into filming.
Well, we need to get Jack.
Yeah, Jack.
Jack and Arnie.
Yeah.
All the
love
great
those guys. all the great Small Town Monsters crew. The Jack, Arnie, Russell.
Tiger.
Yeah, Tiger. We're off the rails.
So
this week we're talking about Terra and the Skies, and I think we've already done an episode at least where we talked a little bit about
Billabong,
favorite clothing brand, where we talked a little bit about Terra and the Skies. Did we do a Thunderbird, like straight up Thunderbird
episode? We did a Thunderbird centric episode,
and we did a Piasaw, mm-hmm. or was that part of the
I think those two sort of blended together.
Okay, we need to do a Piasaw separate episode.
Yes.
And maybe try to get a guest or two on for that when we do that.
And there's a weird origin theory that I've come across. I still need to pick that volume up.
Yeah.
But I had never seen anything like that before.
Yeah. Okay, so Terra in the Skies filmed last. This is where my memory fades. Where my memory escapes me, where my recollections fade like the wind
through the drain
through the drainage ditch
like the
of so we filmed Terra in the Skies last fall, very kind of like early last fall, And I do know that we have all kind of agreed that it was one of our favorite shoots because it was pretty laid back. Like for an STM shoot, we were in one location for most of the interviews, aside from our two witness interviews, we're in like this one location. So that was kind of chill. And we only shot, I think, four interviews while we were there, or five interviews. So it wasn't many. So it wasn't super stressful in that way. Unfortunately, you and Andy were not part of that trip. Just like you weren't part of Missouri, although with Missouri, congratulations, because you missed out on 2.5 days of living hell.
Oh, wow.
Not because of the town or anything like that. Just by far, like one of the most stressful documentary shoots we've ever had, mostly due to like, have we talked since I got back from?
A little bit.
I saw you just the week
during
after.
During the shoot.
Yeah.
And that's, you know. It's
yeah.
Thing.
Lyle's plane like got delayed a day. So he got in. So we missed an entire day of shooting with him and had to cram everything into one
wow.
day. So originally we were supposed to have one day for his monologues and one day for interviews, because all the interviews were scheduled for Friday. Well, he gets in Thursday night instead of Wednesday night. So we pick him up at the airport and then just frantically shot all of his monologues and all the interviews in one day. So we started at like 7 a.m. and finished at like 11 p.m.
Wow.
So it was a really
it's brutal.
Yeah, it was a rough day. And then I had to wake up at 5 o'clock the next morning to take him an hour away to get a flight out. But anyway, this is not about MoMA. This is about Terra in the Skies, which was a blissfully easy shoot. And there was only one live action sort of quote unquote recreation we did for the movie. And that was a crew of me. it was just me and my nephew mm-hmm. that shot all that. So but as a shoot, the shoot itself went easy. There's a really concise featurette on the DVD that kind of walks you through the entire production process beginning to end. And then once we hit post-production, the sort of post-production end of things on this was also kind of like isolated to just like I was doing all the editing and then you and I did the writing. What do we have anything to say? I feel like the writing of this went real smooth too.
Yeah.
Like I feel like the entire production on Terror went really smooth beginning to end, mm-hmm. aside from like some scheduling snafus at the end. Like, what do I have to say about the writing?
The writing. Well, it was really, it flowed really easily because mm-hmm. there was a clear movement from the beginning of how we were going to go through the geography basically drove the story. You know, we went
oh, yeah, yeah.
south to north and then mm-hmm. back again. And that just from that outline preceded everything else. And it was fun. I mean, the tinkering that you and I did the most of was the beginning and the end, you know, kind of trying to bookend the story and get it back to where we wanted it to be.
Yeah, because originally there was, there wasn't, I don't know that the theme of the movie was explicit enough in the beginning. And even the way Lyle worded things was changed at the last minute by Mark and I. And the geography thing's interesting too, because the story is told, it's told chronologically, but it's just chronological through happenstance. Like it isn't, we didn't explicitly set out to like, let's tell a chronological story. I really loved the idea when I got into post and I realized you could tell the story geographically. I thought that was going to be a really cool change up from something like Bray Road or the Mothman of Point Pleasant, where we could, or even Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, Invasion like hops around time in the timeline.
Yeah.
By the way, I accidentally announced we want to do a Invasion on Chestnut Ridge 2 over the weekend while I was at the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure and people were cheering. So we might have to do that at some point.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Shannon LeGros is just lighting me up right now. I've got all these, Shannon, if you're listening. the story's told chronologically, but when we got into the edit, we realized there's a line early on about that either Troy or Lawrence stated about how the geography of the state changes so drastically.
People who don't either know someone or have a family member who had some sort of encounter in their life, in their entire lifetime, even if they don't believe in this kind of stuff, these things tend to happen or are drawn to people. And I think that seems to make Illinois more haunted than other states, but I don't think that's the case. I think they're all very haunted or all drawn to the paranormal. It's just somebody's got to write this stuff down. Somebody's got to collect it.
I grew up in Illinois. I lived in Illinois most of my life from 1947 through 1975. And I really saw Illinois as a little United States.
The state of Illinois is a lot bigger than people think. You try to drive tip to tip in Illinois, it's about an 8-hour drive.
You have the urban area in Chicago, then the river area in the northern part of the state.
You've got Chicago, you've got a big metropolitan area. In northern Illinois, you have the Illinois River and all the bluffs and the wooded areas and the canyons. And then you get into the middle of the state where everything's flat. There just isn't a lot geographically across the middle of the state that's unusual.
To me, there's nothing more beautiful.
And then I was thinking about that fact and then realized that you could do essentially like a geography lesson on the state of Illinois and jump from report to report, and it would actually end up being chronological. So it wasn't purposefully done, but it is beginning to end. Starts in southern Illinois, moves to central, and then ends in northern. As someone who was born and raised in Illinois, though, like what does the movie mean to you?
Well, it does give you a sense of the overall texture of the state. Which is to say, you know, there's this one super urban area. Chicago is almost its own thing. And as soon as you leave Chicago, then it's just as it's described in the film. And as you see, it's either flat farmland or you get over to the western edge and it's Mississippi River and sort of the bluffs and so forth. And then way down south, it's a whole other thing entirely. It's like Southeast Ohio.
Yeah, I was going to say to you when we drove to Louisiana, we experienced the entire state except for really the northernmost part. But that western edge is totally different from the southern edge, which I didn't realize really. Mm-hmm. Like I was expecting, just based on what Lauren and Troy kind of said, you know, they talked about mountains being there. And I was like, there's no mountain. Like when I was, but when you go west, there are like you get there, there they're like, they would be foothills in a state like PA or even Ohio, but I mean, compared to the rest of the state, there it's mountainous. And then you get down into Missouri and it's like, I kept saying what it reminded me of was Montana. When I was in Montana or even Colorado, mm-hmm. you'd be driving and all of a sudden there's just like, it's flat as can be. And then there's just like mountains popping right. up out of nowhere. And that's kind of what it reminded me of without the rocky, you know, like the terrain of the mountains being the way they are out west. But
yeah, along the Mississippi River, you get some really interesting features. You know, there's
we drove through your hometown or
Decatur?
Birthplace? Decatur. Yeah,
we drove that's where
through,
I was born.
We drove
yeah.
right through it on
and
the way.
And Lauren too. Yeah, I mean, that's our claim to fame.
It's yeah,
the Decatur brothers. But
Decatur Bros.
Decatur Bros.
Small Town Monsters yeah. presents Decatur Bros.
Like, there's even these separate legends. Like, there's along the Mississippi River, if you go kind of straight west out of Chicago and all the way to the river, there's a place called Starved Rock State Park. And mm-hmm. it's just this huge palisade or this huge, you know, rocky outcropping where it's called Starved Rock because legend says there was a tribe that was driven to stay on top of that rock by enemies and they just starved them out, almost like a Masada mm-hmm. type situation.
Wow.
So it's really super interesting, that whole...
Is that Shannon texting you?
No. Yeah. That's Troy Taylor saying, hey, what about me?
She's up to 9.
I'm a bro.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was awesome, by the way. I just wanted to say I had read Troy's books, mm-hmm. but I'd never heard him speak until I saw him in the film. And I just was completely impressed. That's one of the strengths of the movie as well, I guess, is... And reviews have said the same thing, that the people that we get to speak in Terror in the Skies is really a super high level, high caliber. I mean, almost all of them have written numerous books on a variety of subjects. And I don't know, when you're working on it, I guess you don't think of it that way necessarily, but taking a few steps back, it's like, yeah, these are about as credentialed a people as you can get to speak on the Thunderbird.
It's funny because we pushed Terror as sort of a spiritual brother to the Mothman of Point Pleasant. And like maybe like because of the subject matter. Yeah. But I've always felt like even from the beginning when we started sort of talking about doing this movie, I've always felt like the movie it's closest to is Invasion on Chestnut Ridge because it's centered on a geographical area rather than like one monster. Mm-hmm. And then it's sort of held together by investigators rather than eyewitnesses. And the difference I think in Invasion is all those guys in Invasion, even though they're investigators, they've witnessed strange things. Whereas in this case, it's not really that. Also, like, this is the first STM movie that is a deep dive into like a phenomenon, like winged cryptids. This is like your introduction to that entire subject. And we've never done a film that was this deep of a dive into like one subject. Mm-hmm. Bray Road kind of does it, but it doesn't go as deep into the entire dogman werewolf subject in general as this one does. And that was sort of like necessity more than anything, because I don't think people are familiar with this subject. So like most people don't even realize Thunderbirds are a thing, which commercially... Why did I do this? But
you're the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
That's what my
favorite thing still about Terror in the Skies is just the pacing, and especially coming off something like Bray, which is so frantic, like the entire, that is a frantic 13 chapters or 11 chapters or whatever is crammed into that movie. And then each one has its own little mini story. And then and then the quick cutting and all that stuff to go from that to Terror, which is like the average B-roll shots on screen for like 5 to 7 seconds. And there's shots in there that are on screen for like 11 to 13 seconds. And this is all stuff like as an editor, you notice like, because that was all consciously done. Mm-hmm. Like the final shot, not the very final shot, but one of the final shots of the movie is that drone shot pulling away from the Midwest. And that shot itself is on screen for like 15 seconds. I mean, mm-hmm. 20 seconds. It's a very long shot. And that was all done very consciously. Sure. And then like Brandon's score, is probably my favorite Dalo score. And he really captured the I kept telling him, like, I want it to feel very melancholy, because I feel like that's the overriding, or maybe the underlying thing, theme in Terror is sort of if you're watching the movie, this isn't maybe explicitly said too much, it's in there, but that idea of like the vanishing Midwest and how these small towns are going to die eventually, unless like something magical happens. Like, we talked about Lawndale in the movie and how Lawndale shrunk down to what it is today, which is like one street, you know, with houses lining both streets. At one time it had gas stations and grocery stores and dance halls and all that. The biggest source of their like big economic source in town, where everyone works or is employed by, is this grain elevator. And the grain elevator's going out, I think, in September. Mm-hmm. It'll be gone. So like that town, I don't know how they stay alive after that. You know?
Right.
So like, to me, that was always, and then what happens to their history, and like, there's a very specific reason the movie ends on the shot it does. And I haven't been asked about it. Mostly people probably just assume they understand what that final shot means. I talked about it at the cryptozoology conference. Like, in my head, that kid is what happens when a story isn't told or retold. Like, that just disappears when the person's life ends. So, yeah, it's also the most cryptozoology centric film we've made. Like, you could argue that like Boggy Creek Monster might be, but it's not about a phenomenon, and this is. And it's also like, I think for a lot of people, it's an introduction to cryptozoology as something other than like Bigfoot, like where you're taking a realistic approach to a very bizarre subject. We got a bunch of questions. Mm-hmm. We got to get into regarding this, and I lost my, I've got all the Monsteropolis page ones, and then we had some left on the community page. Just for listeners, if you aren't following us on Facebook, follow us on Facebook, Monsteropolis Legends, Anomalies, Monsters, or join the Small Town Monsters Facebook group, and you can leave questions and stuff, and we'll, maybe we'll start doing this before every episode, just so we can get some other people chiming in on stuff.
Absolutely.
The first question has nothing to do with Terror in the Skies. So can you come to Australia and make a documentary about Yowies? Probably not anytime soon, just because it's expensive. But our next question that does relate to Terror, Matthew Carver asked, with the film done and getting ready to be released Friday, is there anything you would change, questions you wish you asked in interviews, or something you wish you would have filmed but maybe didn't have time or just didn't make it in the film? Love the podcast and don't stop making these films. Why don't you, like, I know this, you might feel like you don't have a say here, but why don't you chime in on that? Like, what did you wish might have been touched on?
Well, if there were like a director's cut, uh-huh, where you could add 20 minutes or something, I think probably getting into the Native American legends,
that's
even more.
I was going to say, yeah.
Because when you start digging, and Mark Hall's book is an excellent, you know, source for that, it just keeps unfolding. I mean, essentially you walk away with the understanding that these stories are in the legendary, you know, stories of every tribe that was here. And many of them very matter of fact. There's a, you know, I dipped back into that book to get ready for today, and even stories about the like Bald Mountains in the United States as possible lookouts in the deep past for these giant birds is a thing. So that was, I think that would be a good way to expand, is take it in the direction of, you know, what were the various traditions and stories. And, you know, there's similarities between them, but it's the variations and the differences that are so intriguing.
Yeah, I have the exact same answer. Like, that is the thing that is lacking from Terror in the Skies. And it was done out of necessity, mm-hmm, by the way. The fact is, like, I tried to get native elders or someone connected with some sort of Illinois tribe to speak on behalf of like Native Americans. And due to scheduling, we could not get it together. Like the unfortunate thing about Small Town Monsters is we are left with like the tiny budgets we have. So we have X amount of time to shoot in one location. And if we can't get an interview into that time frame that we are filming in Illinois, it's just not going to happen. And what fell by the wayside was that. So in the movie, there are references to like sort of native beliefs and things like that, but we don't do any kind of really deep dive into native cultural views of thunderbirds or winged cryptids in general. It's sort of mentioned in passing. And the unfortunate thing about that is like thunderbirds themselves, like that name kind of comes from the Native Americans. So, but it was done consciously, and I've got plenty of interview with Ken and Chad and Kevin and Lauren and Troy where they talk about native beliefs on this stuff. My issue was having a bunch of white dudes talk about what the natives think just felt weird to me. So eventually I would like to get something. I mean, I'm hoping we can revisit the subject, frankly, because like, and we will be actually, I mean, like I said that and then it hit me like we are sort of revisiting it with the Mothman Legacy. But I don't know how deep it's going to go into anything like Thunderbirds, you know, like I'm sure there's going to be winged cryptids discussed, but, I think the Mothman Legacy is going to be much more centered on Appalachian lore and how, the Mothman story itself is just another variation on lore that's existed in Appalachia going back hundreds of years. And, we'll probably focus very heavily on Men in Black and like UFOs as much as like
nice.
Mothman. Yeah. And at some point we got to get the name Big Hoot into the Mothman Legacy.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that's my answer to that question is I would have liked to have had more of the Native American side of things. Do you want to read Michael Edick's questions?
Sure.
I have them in front of me though, if you want me to get it.
Yeah, I will do that. I'll do yours first.
Okay, yes, yeah.
Seth, my brother, do you ever have live call-ins for your podcast / radio show, or do you ever do live Facebook broadcasts?
We do on Small Town Monsters. We do occasional live stuff. We used to do a show called Small Town Monsters Live that I think we recorded 3 episodes of. It wasn't much.
Yeah.
and that was kind of driven by viewer Q&A. And the problem is like when you do that stuff, if you don't have a large audience tuning in, you're left kind of sitting there twiddling your thumbs, asking people to ask questions. Mark and I did the first block of Monsteropolis shows live. We did it. It was like 3 hours. So and it's still on the page. So if you go back, you can actually watch the first 3 episodes recorded live. Like I said earlier, I think we might start doing these movie centric episodes live because that would be a cool way for listeners and viewers to interact. And we could kind of have that driven by questions from the audience. And we could launch that over on the STM page too, so it would garner a larger audience. But other than that, we have not done much live with Monsteropolis yet. But we've got stuff coming up this month. Like we're going to be together in PA. And then in July, we've got the live show in Pittsburgh, which we need to plug actually. July 19th at the Black Forge Coffee House in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we are doing a live show. Tickets are $5 to $10. And this was organized by our buddy and loyal listener, Matthew Shang. So if you're in the Pittsburgh area or anywhere within driving distance of Pittsburgh, swing through and you can hang out with us. I will say from what I understand, there's very limited seating.
Oh,
it's not a huge venue. And, I do know some people, I don't know if they're pre-sailing tickets or tickets pre-sailers at the door.
I think at the door.
So here's the thing. I know at least over the weekend, I had at least 6 or 7 people come to the table and say they're coming to it.
No kidding.
Yeah, in PA. And online, we've been told by at least a dozen people that they're coming to it. And the event page itself has like 70 people. So if you are planning on coming to this live show, show up early, because I'm not saying we're a huge draw, but I am saying I've been told by a number of people, like as many people as there are seats in the place, that they're coming. So I guess if worst came to worst, we would just do a backup show. We'd just do 2 shows back to back.
Right.
Just have them come in the second shift.
And we're going to sell sketches.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll do a caricatures of the audience members. It's going to be great.
Yep.
Okay. So that answers that question. Black Forge Coffee House.
Yep.
July 19th. It's Saturday night or Friday night? I can't remember.
Friday night.
Yeah. July 19th. See you there.
All right. Well, this is sort of self-directed, but it's, when are you, Mark Matsky, and your crew getting yourselves back out to Western Washington State? The Tri-Cities is a little bit far from Tacoma. I have added you to my must-meet list. Wow. Hmm. That's super cool. Well, here's the thing. I mean, I don't know when, but it's going to happen, because I think about that region all the time, having dipped our toe in it, whatever
I'll extend this invitation to you right now. I'm going later this year because we're going to do on the trail of filming. Mm-hmm. So it would be like Shannon and myself. But I know for a fact we're going out there. It's just when I'm doing the desert states in the next 3 weeks. I leave for like Nevada and Utah and all that stuff. But the Pacific Northwest trip is going to be happening later this summer, probably later this summer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it'll be September or August, but we'll see what happens. But you are invited if you want to go.
Excellent. Ooh. Yeah. So Mike, it might be soon.
So yeah, I mean, maybe we'll try, you know, like a big, maybe we'll try to get some sort of live show scheduled out there. I know a couple of venues and owners of venues out there who have actually asked us about coming out. So we might try to do something out in either Washington or even Oregon, depending on you know, like who wants to have us. Okay, so the other questions are on the STM community group page, and I'm trying to frantically pull them up. Wait. Oh, here it is. I have it all.
Got him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fittingly, the first question is from Matthew Shang. In your research and with the people you interviewed for the film, are the pterodon-type thunderbirds seen as more avian reptilian animals or something more paranormal? And this is per research and with people you interviewed for the film. Are the pterodon...
That's a super cool question, actually.
...seen as more avian reptilian animals or something more paranormal?
Doesn't it seem, I mean, to me, it seems, it depends on what region you're talking about.
Yeah. I was going to say, because like Chestnut Ridge, there's a lot of weird Thunderbird type reports from that area. Now, when he's saying pterodon, are we talking pterodactyl?
Yeah.
Okay. Pterodactyl type?
Because like,
isn't the pterodon itself, or the pterotorn?
Yeah, see, that's the...
That's a winged, like, thunderbird-type creature. Mm-hmm. But then there's the pterodon.
From the fossil record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, like, I came away from this thinking there was very little to the subject of flying cryptids that seemed paranormal to me. Like, obviously, I'm going to set aside something like the Chicago Mothman stuff. Mm-hmm. But, like, none of it seems all that rooted in completely... In like the unexplained, like I think most Thunderbird reports are explainable. And whether that's through saying they're misidentifying known birds, or it's some sort of abnormally large bird, I think you can explain it. When you get into the pterodactyl reports or whatever, things get a little weirder. 'Cause like, how are they, if they exist, where are they hiding? There'd have to be it's very strange in a country where there's airplanes all over the place. Mm-hmm. And then you could probably bring in the paranormal and be like, well, maybe they came through a wormhole, or like I saw someone posit the other day somewhere that maybe and it might have even been at the Pennsylvania Bigfoot Camping Adventure, but they threw out the idea that maybe that's exactly where it was actually. No, okay. Someone came to our table and was telling me this. They thought that maybe like the pterodactyl type reports are ghosts. Like, why can't there be ghosts of animals if there are ghosts of people? Or, you know, like, especially if you're subscribing to the idea, like, there's this theory that ghosts are just energy left behind by, you know, like some powerful event that happened before. Well, maybe like
a recording.
Sure. Almost. Yeah. Well, maybe that's what people are seeing when they see like a pterodactyl or something. You know, like Kyle Danhausen very clearly saw what he claimed was like a pterodactyl type bird fly over his field when he was hunting.
Watching them hunt. So the dogs were down in the ditch. My friend yelled, "Look," and I looked over at him. He was to my left and I saw him pointing above me. I never saw it. And I looked up and there was a massive bird right over the top of our dogs. He later said that he thought they were coming, that bird was coming after our dogs, and that made sense to me because it was right above us.
So, how do you explain that? You know, I'm not going to write off what he said because the guy's one of the most believable witnesses I've ever spoken to. But at the same time, like, you can't explain it. Like, where would they exist? How do they exist? Yeah. How do we not know, you know, they're there? So there's a lot of like paranormal theories when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you hear sometimes the pterodactyl type creatures reported in the desert Southwest, and there's a slightly more plausible to that, you know, where there's not a whole lot
there's not a lot of people out there.
So maybe, but yeah, the thing I love about that report in the film is how he's asked, or he recounts having like his boss say, "Hey, tell your story."
Yeah,
you know, like it really did become sort of a thing that he had to deal with.
Yeah, and he, you know, like I think it's, he briefly mentions it too, but people really did like mock him for that to an extent. So every witness we spoke to in this, they've been hesitant to come forward with their sighting because for some reason it seems like the idea of a thunderbird or a large bird is more outlandish than something like a Bigfoot to some people.
Yeah, Marlon Lowe's mother, Ruth Lowe?
Yeah.
Who said she would, if she had to do it all over again, she wouldn't have said anything.
Yeah. Mike Warhalik, for those who haven't seen it in the documentary, spoiler alert. For those who haven't seen it, in the documentary, Lauren Coleman says that Marlon Lowe had turned completely gray by the time he visited the family 2 years after the Lawndale incident. Any additional info on that? Perhaps a picture. I thought this was actually a good question because I had the same question myself. Like, it paints a great visual image and it's very sad, but you know, like, can we find a picture of like gray haired 11-year-old or 12-year-old Marlon Lowe? I haven't seen one. However, he is in Monster Quest's Birdzilla episode from like 10 years ago. And he does have gray hair. It's under a hat, but he has like, it's clearly gray hair. But again, he's much older now, so he might have gray hair regardless. But no, I don't have any photos from that, and I don't know if you have any insight there.
No photos, but Mark Hall evidently followed up in talking to the Lowe family, and I think he corroborates it just based off of his own, you know, his own visual identification. But I don't know how long after. I think that might have been at least 10 years.
Jerry Coleman, Lauren's brother, was also part of the group that like investigated flying cryptids. And he was with Lauren on a number of those journeys, you know, to Lawndale and stuff. And I know that he was part of talking to them. And in fact, Lauren thinks the photo that I have in the movie in Terror in the Skies of the Lowe family standing outside of the trailer, it's a color photo. It's really cool. He believes that might've been taken by Jerry.
Hmm.
So yeah, I don't have anything to corroborate Lauren's claim about Marlon going gray. But it seems like other people might have, especially Mark Hall. Vance wanted to know, Vance Nesbitt, I live in St. Charles, Illinois, and Allison Joyland sent me a link of a newspaper article. She sent me the same article, actually, of a large bird attacking a farmer child. The article explains that he fought this 10-foot wingspan bird for quite some time. So your take on that? I know there have been cases of gigantism that have affected certain birds and animals. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I think gigantism is actually... I had never considered this until we got to Alton and I learned about the world's tallest man.
Robert Wadlow.
Robert Wadlow, who was in Alton, lived in Alton. And all of a sudden it was like, well, that's a really cool synchronicity that you're in this town sort of known for a large bird attack or a large bird flap that happened in the 40s. And it happens to be in the same town where the largest man, you know, who lived at the time, lived. Maybe there's something in the water there that's just morphing people. No, but I believe, I firmly believe that is a possibility. Like, there's no reason why a bird couldn't grow larger than other birds of its kind, you know, like why there couldn't be anomalous incidences where a bird could become abnormally mm-hmm. large. At least that's my thinking on it.
Yeah. And as to the type of story that he's talking about, you know, an attack, mm-hmm. there's a surprisingly big body of literature, you know, especially from the classic mid to late 18th or 19th century mm-hmm. of attacks. And, you know, some of those are identified typically in the newspapers of the time as eagles, which gets fans of eagles kind of up in arms because they always argue, well, no eagle's big enough to make off, even with a baby, mm-hmm. even though there's so many stories about, you know, specifically eagles carrying children away from schoolyards and so forth, but I just multiply the size. And that, I guess that's the whole thing with the cryptozoological angle is how big do you have to get a bird, like a known species of bird, if it's just a giant. Well,
even an Andean condor, which is what the Low family described what they saw. They described it as being basically like an Andean condor. A known Andean condor can't really pick up a 70-pound kid and fly off. It essentially can pick up to half its body weight, sometimes two-thirds its body weight. But you would still need a bird that weighed anywhere from like 120 pounds to 140 pounds. And birds are like notoriously light because their bones are mm-hmm. hollow, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So they don't weigh much at all. Like even a huge bird doesn't weigh very much. So you're looking at a condor that would have had to have weighed around 120 to 140 pounds just to pick up Marlon Lowe.
Sure. I mean, the lift that's mm-hmm. necessary to yeah. do that. I mean, there's some theories that have been put out there about, you know, updrafts helping birds of prey to lift heavier, but that's in mountainous regions where you have like huge updrafts.
And
not next to somebody's house.
Ken talks about that updraft though, that comes with the storm at the forefront of storms, which is why he believes that Native Americans would have seen these thunderbirds sort of riding the updraft in ahead of a storm. And also which would help sort of further the idea of being a forebearer of bad things. Like if they're at the front of a storm, you've got a storm oncoming and here comes a giant bird sort of as the forebearer of bad news.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a shockingly large body of reportage that has to do with large birds in North America making off with all types of, you know, basically any mammal that you can think of, everything from little kids to cattle and everything in between.
Yeah. There's a report Paul Bestall told me about while I was recording his Mysteries and Monsters show with him. And he's in Great Britain and he was talking about a report I'd never heard of and I'm not even going to try to recount it, but it involved, I think, a little girl being carried off by a giant bird. And this was highly reported on. He said it's fact, like it actually happened. So, these things happen. It's scary stuff. We don't really push the scary angle with our movie Terror in the Skies for some reason. We're going for melancholy and sad. So
yeah.
Okay. Anyway, this should cover it for Terror in the Skies talk. We will do another one of these movie-centric episodes when we get to Momo, and we'll probably do a few of them because there's a lot to talk about, and we want to get Adam in here to talk about his experience making it and your experience making it. We'll need Andy in here. So we'll probably do multiple episodes about that. Maybe at some point we can get Bobo and Cliff to come on. So the movie's out. Check it out on Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, VidiSpace, or DVDs through smalltownmonsters.com. You can leave us a Monsteropolis review on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you listen through. And leave us a... I just almost said the exact same thing. You can send an email if you want to get your emails read on the show. MonsteropolisMail@gmail.com. And I think that covers it. Oh, Black Forge Coffee House, July 19th.
Yes.
See you there.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.